Hi there, welcome to another Oss the Podcast. My name's Todd Fraser. I'm here with another episode from the 21st Annual ANZIC CTG Conference in Noosa, Australia. And with me today is Alistair Nicol, one of the lead investigators of the POLAR study of hypothermia in traumatic brain injury, which was published in JAMA in 2018. Alistair, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
It must feel like the culmination of quite a journey for those involved in the POLAR trial. It's been a long journey to get to this point. How does it feel on this end of it?
So, no, you're completely correct. This has been a very long journey. This trial would have started with funding in 2007, with the first patient in 2010, and with the finishing of the trial in 2017 and publication last year. So it's been over a decade. So it's been a Herculean task for all of the investigators, with Jamie Cooper, who's led this, to get this to this stage. So we're delighted to have successfully delivered the study.
Congratulations, yeah. It is a big achievement, and when people see these in the journals, they often don't appreciate the work that has come before their publication.
Well, I mean, it's 10 years of your life. So when I started this, I had a mullet, no children, and now I have grey hair and 4 kids. So lots of things change in a 10-year period.
And I was looking at one of the sites related to POLAR and looked at the number of presentations that have been given and papers that have been published around it, in addition to the ultimate publication. And it's an extraordinary effort by a lot of people.
Yeah, no, so the amount of work to understand the question we wanted to ask from the start and then how to refine that question has been a huge amount of work. And with any intervention you want to deliver to people who are critically unwell, you want to make sure it's safe, it's done in the most timely, most effective manner. So there was a huge amount of work in understanding the literature before we actually even developed our intervention. Never mind trying to figure out all of the other signals from the trial now it's actually finished.
So traumatic brain injury is obviously a very common pathology and has potentially very devastating impacts, obviously. So there's a lot of interest in what can be done to mitigate the effects of it. What was the background to the hypothermia trial and how it works in traumatic brain injury?
So you touched on two really important points there. So first of all, traumatic brain injury is devastating. It generally affects young people, predominantly young males, because they tend to do stupid things. And it has a massive effect on the individual, but their families, the society as a whole. So it's devastating. So anything that we can do to reduce the morbidity and mortality will have a huge impact for society as a whole. And so this is like time travel. So you have to go back to 2007. And so for the first time, there was a US group that really promulgated the guidelines for traumatic brain injury called the Brain Trauma Foundation. And for the first time, they published a meta-analysis which suggested that early, so this is prophylactic hypothermia, may actually reduce death mortality and may improve functional outcome. So functional outcome is what's really important in traumatic brain injury. Not only do you want to be alive, but you want to be able to get your life back to what it was before. And on the back of this, they made a weak recommendation for the clinical use of hypothermia. And that was the first time that it ever happened. Now, there were a lot of small trials that had looked at this question before, but did many limitations. They didn't cool people quick enough. They didn't cool them for long enough. They warmed them up too quickly. So there were lots of reasons to think that if there was a benefit, that other trials really didn't detect it. And the other problem was, so this is a hard intervention to deliver. We were asking, this recommendation would have suggested, say, to paramedics, to ED clinicians, to IC clinicians, to start a therapy of cooling people really early. And that's a big undertaking. It's expensive. It's the logistics. So that recommendation didn't translate into practice, because there were too many questions. So a trial needed to be conducted to answer this question. And this is what the POLAR trial was. And then the other thing was, as I said, we started putting this together in 2007, started the trial in 2010. So then some other evidence accumulated over that decade when we were doing it. So the big one was the Eurotherm study. And there were two other studies called NABISH 1 and 2, well, NABISH 2, which suggested that actually hypothermia may not be beneficial. And one of the trials, again, they didn't cool people for quickly enough or for long enough, so the questions remained. And then the second trial used hypothermia, actually in a different context, used it late as a treatment when the pressures in the head had already got really high. And actually a lot of people thought that the horse had already bolted at that stage. If the hypothermia was going to work, it needed to be initiated earlier. So while the late use of hypothermia was out, the question about early hypothermia or prophylactic hypothermia was still very much alive.
So as you say, the urotherm was really used more as a rescue therapy, I guess, wasn't it? Whereas Polar tried to focus more on early intervention, including pre-hospital to some degree.
Yeah, so look, our hypothesis was, and look, if hypothermia is going to work, it'll work through a number of different mechanisms. And they will be to actually reduce the inflammation and swelling that happens in the brain, to actually mean that this whole cascade doesn't get out of control, that the pressures don't get really high, and actually to avoid the periods of really high pressures in the head that occur. And that is when the hypothermia was used for urotherm. And we felt it was unlikely to have an effect on that stage because it was really late. If you want to see if hypothermia works, you have to induce it early, and that really means trying to get pre-hospital or patients enrolled in emergency departments.
So in terms of bench data and preclinical studies, how early do we need to be starting hypothermia to mitigate some of those impacts pathologically?
Yeah, so and I suppose the answer is as soon as possible. So looking at the animal data and going back, so a lot of those studies did what they can do in the lab is they induce hypothermia before the injury, right? So that's great, and it shows that it was effective, but that's useless in clinical practice, if you know what I mean, because you cannot do that. And then some of the other studies induced hypothermia really quickly, within a few hours. What those studies seemed to suggest was as early as possible, and earlier the better. And in our study, we tried to enroll patients within 3 hours of their injury.
Is that based on what we know from a preclinical type scenario? Is that early enough? Is one of the troubles with hypothermia studies is that it's just not feasible to start hypothermia as early as it could potentially be done?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And this is where perfect science in the laboratory intersects with real life. So to get in your heads, this trial was really interesting for a number of reasons, but one was like the paramedics and stuff involved were just outstanding, right? So two cars would collide on the freeway. The traffic behind would get all backed up, the police would come, the ambulances would be on the way, a helicopter would land, and the paramedics would get out. And the scene would be in front of them with the traffic cones, all the traffic backed up, debris all over the motorway. And not only would they be then trying to stabilize the patient, their airway, intubate them, they then are randomizing this patient to either cool them for the hypothermia arm or normal therapy at the side of the road. So to get patients in this environment is difficult and challenging. So I think we got as early as practically possible. And the other thing to mention is not only do they have to enroll patients in the study, they have to exclude major other complications that may mean the patient's not suitable. So it was a big ask, and we were pretty amazed we were actually able to deliver it as well as we did.
And to that end, you managed to get patients who were randomised to the hypothermia arm down to 35 degrees within a couple of hours as a general rule, and then down to 33 degrees within 10 hours for the majority?
Yeah, so, and again, that was a reflection of an imperfect world. So we had so the previous meta-analysis had suggested that the best target temperature was between 33 and 35. And we had thought that probably 33 would be better than 35. And what we thought we would do would be people at that roadside would be randomized and the paramedics would target 35. So that would get the patient into the temperature zone that would protect the brain, but not put them at additional risk of bleeding, because bleeding is a main complication of major trauma, and hypothermia can make bleeding worse. So 35 would be the sweet spot that the patient could then be transferred to the emergency department, scanned, major bleeding excluded, and then cooled further. So what we find is we were able to cool people to 35 as quickly as we would like to, so within a few hours, However, to get the patients down to 33 degrees, it took longer. It took nearly 10 hours. And I think that probably reflected the difficulty of scanning a patient, getting multiple opinions, and then sort of getting the go to cool the patient right down. Now, for the delivery of the intervention, during those period of times, the patients were 35 or less. So I think that was, if hyperthermia was going to have an effect, I think we were in the sweet spot to see it.
So the strategy that you used for cooling pre-hospital was cold saline, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And then patients were maintained at a low temperature with external cooling devices. Is that correct?
So the answer is yes. So at the roadside, it was common in many of the paramedic services that they would give her a liter of fluid while they intubate the patient or afterwards. We just substituted that for room temperature fluid to ice cold. Normally patients are covered and kept warm as they're brought to the hospital. People in the hyperthermia group, they were actually exposed in the back of the ambulance to assist cooling down to 33. And once they arrived in the emergency department, the people and the patients in the hyperthermia arm had surface cooling pads on their body and on their limbs. And then this controlled the temperature at 35. And then once the bedside clinicians were happy to go to 33, it then would have rapidly reduced them to 33. And so that's how we hoped to deliver hyperthermia early. And the other advantage of this method was it's pretty good at controlling temperature. So one of the methodological advantages of our trial, we thought, was we kept them cold for longer, much longer than the other studies.
Yep. So what was that period? How long did you keep them cold for?
So a lot of the previous studies had done 24 or 48 hours and then just rewarmed the patient, right? So that would have been like if a patient is shocked and you start noradrenaline and keep their blood pressure up, but you turn it off after 2 days, right? That just doesn't make sense. That's not how we work in the real life or we work at the bedside. So what we thought was we keep them cold for at least 3 days because that is the period when the brain swelling gets worse and then starts to subside. The previous studies actually started to warm the patients when the brain swelling was probably the worst. And that was probably the worst time. We actually really thought that was a confounding effect of the previous studies. So we kept them cold for 3 days. Then we measured the pressure in their brains. And if the pressure was normal, we started to warm them up. If it wasn't, we kept them cold for up to a week. And actually, as we started to warm them up really gradually, if the pressure in the brain rose, we stopped cooling them. So we not only do we try and cool them early, to cool them for long, we only rewarm them slowly when the pressures in the brain were normal. So we thought that was the optimal way to deliver hypothermia.
So POLA was published in 2018. What did the results show?
So look, so we published, so the POLA investigators with Jamie, myself, and a whole cast of transplant work published this in October 2018 in JAMA, and we were delighted to get at that stage. And it showed, so our primary outcome measure was neurological function, which is called a GOSE, and we dichotomized it into favourable or unfavourable, so favourable being good. And our results showed that prophylactic hyperthermia did not improve long-term functional outcomes.
Were you and the rest of the investigators surprised by that result?
Yeah, so yes, to be very honest, back in 2007 when I started this, I would have bet the house on it, right?
Yeah.
I actually would have, the evidence seemed so clear. It just needed a trial with the right features, and we worked really hard to design that. We took nearly 7 years to deliver it, and I really thought it was going to be effective. I really, really did. Now, some of my colleagues with the negative publications of that NABUSH 2 study and with the Eurotherm study were wondering would it be effective or not. But in a sense, while we were very disappointed that it wasn't effective, it was a clean kill in a sense that it showed that it did not work. Not that it might work and we just should have done this or that. It just did not work. And that is a real useful piece of knowledge for a few reasons. One is there were lots of people who still thought this was beneficial. It takes a lot of time, effort, and money to do. And we have shown that early cooling of patients is not beneficial. So I think that will end the prophylactic hypothermia story. Now, there's another really interesting thing about our study. So the takeaway message is not The patient's temperature after severe traumatic brain injury doesn't matter, because that's not the question. Because we cooled people, but in our control group, we kept them on the nose 37. We kept them temperature really tightly monitored.
Yeah.
And I think the take-home from our study is the optimal treatment is to keep their temperature on 37 as you can, because we would have used surface pads to keep the control group patient's normal temperature.
Yeah.
And I think that's the take-home message. It's not whatever you fancy yourself. It's 37 and very careful about it.
Yeah. Alistair, I can only imagine after such a prolonged period that finding that result as a negative trial could have been quite devastating in many ways for the group, because you do invest emotionally very heavily in these trials, don't you?
Yeah, no, so you'll probably only have so many of these big endeavours in you during a professional career. And so that's why, I mean, you don't take these things on willy-nilly. It's a big commitment in time, effort, taxpayers' money to find the results. So in a way, so we did all our due diligence at the start. And as I said before, hand on heart, we thought this was really going to work. The answer is of equal use to our community. They can say, right, 37 is what we do after this. We keep them normothermic. And then all our efforts can move on to a different question and our time and interest. And the other thing is, that is just, that's the headline takeaway message from this. There will be lots more information about our current treatment of patients with severe traumatic brain injury that will come out of this and be useful for our community.
What do you think were the reasons why this study didn't work? I'm sure that you've reflected on this as a group and individually. Do you look back and think, well, maybe there's some reasons? Was it the fact that hypothermia was associated with complications that potentially impact? Or was it to do with the therapy itself? I would imagine that the bolusing of 2 litres of cold crystalloid could have impacts physiologically. What do you think might have explained that negative result?
Yeah, so maybe I'll take you on a journey just very briefly through. So our headline result was that hypothermia didn't increase long-term functional outcomes significantly. It didn't increase survival significantly. And so doing these trials make you, by nature, completely self-critical, right? So our first question was, well, maybe we didn't do it right. So even though we thought we were highfalutin and we this fancy protocol, maybe we didn't do what we said we did in the tin. So if we were to be critical, we got the patients to 35 as quickly as we wanted, but not to 33. So maybe that was a limitation. Okay. Now is it possible to do better? I'm not sure. Two big studies have tried hard and managed to do not better than we have done. The second question is not all our patients reached 33 because some of the patients didn't have severe traumatic brain injury. They were at the side of the road. Unfortunately, they had taken intoxicating substances or other silly things that young men do. And they were pulled out of the study and warmed up and treated as they would be normally treated. That might have confounded our ability to detect a result, because some people didn't have traumatic brain injury and they were included in the study. So obviously you can't improve their outcomes because they didn't have the indexed disease. So we did two subsequent analyses, a per protocol analysis to see if we look at the people who got the protocol as we sort of defined it, so roughly about 50% of the amount of hypothermia they should have got, did they do better, if you know what I mean? And now it's a sort of after the fact analysis and the results are subject to some bias. However, it was clear again, no effect. And then we looked at a second analysis looking at the patients, irrespective of what group they were in, if you were cold versus warm, how did you do? And again, there was no effect at all. So we didn't see any benefit of hypothermia through all of these things. So the question then is, does hypothermia just not work, right? Which is possibly what it is. Were the other studies biased? Were their control groups really warm? They were doing bad things there that actually meant hypothermia wasn't good, it's just their normal care was worse. And by us keeping our control normothermic group at 37, maybe we got rid of all that badness. So we just treated our control group better not the intervention group, better. Or, as you say, maybe hypothermia causes harm. And there's the Eurotherm study showed there's definitely a potential for that. So the fluid could have done it. Our patients would have got 1 litre extra, generally, of crystalloid. So is that enough in the grand scheme of things? Who knows? We worked really hard because the previous studies had shown in the hypothermia group their patients got more and more fluid as the days went on. So we worked really hard to limit that. And the additional fluid burden in the hypothermia patients was pretty minimal in the POLAR trial. But there are other things. We know hypothermia can contribute to bleeding, so we looked at that. So there wasn't significant increased bleeding either in the brain or elsewhere. It can be predisposed to infection. And in our overall analysis, we showed a non-significant increase in pneumonia. But in those per-protocol analysis, there was a significant increase in pneumonia. So maybe by keeping these patients cooler for longer, we are predisposing them to infections that maybe outweigh any additional benefit.
So what's next in this area? Is this the definitive trial, or is there still more to come in the hypothermia in traumatic brain injury story?
So the hypothermia in traumatic brain injury story, it's got chapters. It's like an Agatha Christie book. It's got chapters. So the Eurotherm, which is the late rescue hypothermia, Eurotherm's answered that. That's done. The prophylactic hypothermia question, which is what the POLAR trial was, I think it's addressed that as well. And they are the two big questions in this field. There are some smaller questions that is late rescue hypothermia for a retractable ICP elevation useful? We don't know. And on Twitter and on social media, some other investigators were wondering, what is the answer to those questions? And the answer is, our trial does not answer that. I don't know the answer. They'd be very difficult to address, and they aren't as an immediate burning need for our community. So I don't think we'll be taking those up.
Alistair Nicol, thank you very much for your time on the podcast.
A pleasure. And I'd just like to thank Jamie Cooper and all of the other POLAR investigators, in particular Tony Trapani, who was the project manager over 10 long and painful years. Thank you.
This concludes another episode of the OSLA podcasts. For more great interviews, please visit our website at www.force.com.